Thanks for visiting the Whence We Came Project podcast, an archived audio anthology of American lives, both local and legendary, as told by the Americans that live them. The following is my second conversation with Bob Whitaker, where he goes a bit deeper on the important things in life and even tells a few tales of some folks you may have heard of in country music lore. I found it to be a great conversation with a great man. I hope that you enjoy.
John, you and I have seen such a change in the culture in our communities and in our countries. You know, I think back, again, I'm commenting back to Cookeville, Tennessee. I didn't have a car, but I played baseball in the summer, and I would get out on Highway 70 at Double Springs, and I would hitchhike to Cookeville, Tennessee, and I would get off on Park Avenue and walk to the Park Avenue baseball park in order to play. And when the game was over that evening or that night, I would go back and I'd hitchhike back to Double Springs.
And how old were you?
I was playing 14 years old. Mom and Dad was working in the afternoon when I needed to get to the baseball park, so I had to hitchhike. Now, oftentimes, I didn't have to hitchhike on because Mom and Dad would be at the games.
Right.
But if for some reason they couldn't, I had no fear of going out on the street and hitchhiking back to Double Springs. I wouldn't do that now for anything.
No.
And I wouldn't want my children or my grandchildren to do that. But that was the culture in our area. And most of the time, whoever would stop and pick me up, they would say, "Hey, Bob, going on?" You know.
Well, I guess I hope that with that pendulum swings back. I know we won't get all of that back, but at least the love for neighbor. I hope that the country kind of takes a step back and starts seeing. And I hope that's part of what this does. I hope that this Whence We Came project, I really hope that that through these conversations with people and the folks to get to listen to these conversations, not only do we capture the history and teach our young people that history doesn't mean it has to come from a book. History is sitting across from me on this couch right now, and that is with everyone. I'm hopeful that maybe we start seeing, embraced each other.
That would be a wonderful thing, but you know, unfortunately, the Golden Rule does not have the presence as it had then.
True.
You know, do unto others as you would have them to do unto you.
You, exactly.
The respect that we have for each other and our each other's ideas, that would be important if we could go back and, "Hey, John, I don't necessarily agree with where you stand on that issue, but that's your privilege."
Right.
And I would hope that you would give me the same opportunity.
Yep.
To have my feelings and you respect that feeling. My mom and dad would punish my brothers and I if they heard us talking bad about someone else.
Wow, how the times have changed.
We just were not allowed to do that. The word liar was not allowed in our house.
Wow.
I could not say John Doe is a liar in our house. That just would not happen. And today, you know, people are called everything. And
I know, it's amazing. There's
no respect for.
So let me. I got us off. Let me get us back to. I want to hear how you got to the Grand Ole Opry and Opryland and all that. From now, you're back in Cookeville. You're driving a school bus, and you've gone back to Tech.
All right. I graduated. And I got a job at the Ford Glass Plant in Nashville, Tennessee, in the Labor Relations Department.
Yes, sir.
And I worked there for 3 years. And my boss came in to me one day and he said, "Bob, they're sending the plane down from Dearborn tomorrow. They want you to come up and interview for a job in Dearborn." And I said, "Mr. Franchi, they need to stop that plane. They don't need to burn the gas. I'm not going to live in Detroit, Dearborn, Michigan. Not going to go there. Not going to happen."
Yes, sir.
And he said, "Are you serious?" He said, "This is an opportunity for you. They're looking to promote you to a corporate job. And I said, Gene, I'm not going. No way am I going to Detroit. All right. Well, he twisted my arm and he said, look, if I can't get you on that plane, that's going to affect me. I said, okay, I'll get on that plane. But it's useless. So I went to Dearborn. I interviewed with three or four different people. Spent the night there. Went to the airport the next morning. Got on the company plane. And on the way back to Nashville, I wrote my resignation letter.
Wow.
Because I knew that if I turned down that job, which I was going to do.
Yes, sir.
That I would be stuck right there. My growth in that Ford Motor Company would be gone because I had turned down a corporate opportunity.
Yes, sir.
So it was time for me to look for another job. Now, again, I did not know how important this was going to be. But I interviewed with a company in Indiana, just outside of Evansville. Mount Vernon, Indiana, as a matter of fact, with Babcock and Wilcox in their industrial relations department. And they had government contracts. And one of the things at that time was you had to have a plan where you could integrate and do different things, particularly if you had a government contract. You had to have a plan, and you had to meet that requirement. And so I was hired to get that particular plant in compliance with government requirements.
Yes, sir.
In other words, I was to hire black people and minorities into that
company. I understood where you were going. Yes, sir.
So I went there on a contract basis, and I asked them to, if I got them in compliance, and something else came up, I could take it. And long story short, the job opened up with Minnie Pearl Chicken Company.
Oh, like the Minnie Pearl?
Like Mrs. Sarah Cannon.
Right. Amazing.
Minnie Pearl. And in the personnel department. So I went to work in the personnel department at Minnie Pearl Chicken Company, which got me back to Nashville.
That was in Nashville.
And
wow.
Actually, I've got this story reversed. I went to work for Minnie Pearl Chicken Company before I went to Babcock and Wilcox in Indiana because, unfortunately, the Minnie Pearl Chicken Company didn't work, and so I was out of the job, and I went to Indiana. And then the National Life and Accident Insurance Company announced they were going to build a theme park in Nashville, Tennessee.
Opryland?
Opryland.
I didn't realize that.
So now I'm in Indiana. I'm in compliance. I've fulfilled my obligation. I came to Nashville and I interviewed with the people at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company who were big sponsors of the Boy Scouts when I was a district executive back in 61, 62, and 63.
And it had come full circle. That's amazing.
Now, so I got the job as the first personnel manager, and I worked with Mr. Louis Jumonville, who had a career with the National Life and Accident Insurance Company, and they brought him out to Opryland, and then he was the director and I was the manager. I hired the original staff that opened the theme park in 1972.
Wow.
Okay. So all of that, not taking a music scholarship and getting a degree in business and getting a degree or with emphasis on working with people in sociology and psychology and labor relations and all of those stuff that I'd had with the different companies, has now brought me to a entertainment park.
Yes, sir.
Whose emphasis was on live shows.
Yes, sir.
Music.
Remarkable.
So I was the personnel manager for 3 years. In 1975, the entertainment director resigned, and my boss came to me and he said, Bob, we want you to come over and be the director of the entertainment department. And I looked him in the eye and I said, Julio, do you want me to give up 11 years in the human resources area to go over and work with those crazies? He said, what are you? He said, we need you to do that because you know how to read a budget sheet, and those people over there don't know how to read the budget sheets. They read music.
Great point.
They don't read budget sheets, and right. We need a businessman to go over there and run that department. He didn't know that I'd turned down music scholarship.
He didn't know that.
He didn't know that. There was no reason for them, those people to know that.
Wow.
So I said, I don't want to go over there. I said, let me go find you a businessman that can run that department. And so I put out some feelers, and I went to New York and to Chicago and to Los Angeles, and I interviewed probably 12 or 15 people. And I came back home from that trip, and my wife said to me, Julia wants you in his office at 7 o'clock in the morning. Well, I assumed that he was wanting to see what I had found. So I got out all of my resumes and made my notes and made my who I wanted to recommend. I went into his office and I opened up my briefcase. He said, close that. He said, you're going over to the entertainment department. I went into his office and I opened up my briefcase. Julio said, close that. He said, you're going over to the entertainment department. Bud Wendell and I have talked about it. You're the guy we want. You're going over there.
Who's Bud Wendell?
Bud Wendell at that time was the CEO.
Oh, wow. Okay.
and a marvelous guy, as was Tullio Perpoli. Rotund Italian guy running. He started out at Opryland as the food and beverage director, and then he moved up to the general manager off the park.
Yes, sir.
Bud was the CEO, a former manager of the Grand Ole Opry.
Wow.
Who had worked as a debit salesman for the National Life and Accident Insurance Company. He moved from there to the Grand Ole Opry to Opryland. Julio came from Disneyland to Opryland.
Oh, wow.
And I came from industrial relations. He said, we want you to go over there. I said, okay, I'll take it for 6 weeks. And if I don't like it, you can fire me. I'll go get another job. Because I was really happy doing my labor relations, personnel, human resource. I enjoyed it, and I was comfortable with it. I went over to the entertainment department, and there were some opportunities that we had there in terms of dealing
very,
with.
Very tactfully said.
You know, there were some opportunities for that. I can tell you that it took me a very short time to find out that those crazies that I was talking about were just wonderful, good people who just had a different talent than I had and that most people had.
Yes, sir.
They were singers, dancers, and musicians and technicians.
Right.
And writers and directors and choreographers, okay?
Right.
So, and those people loved what they were doing, and they loved the fact that they were working in Nashville, Tennessee, where they could have an opportunity, particularly the singers, have an opportunity to get recording contracts. Musicians could get into studio work or could get a job traveling with one of the stars. You know, so it was one of those things where people loved what they were doing, and people came from all over the country to see the shows and watch these young people on stage. And all of a sudden, I just said, Lord, thank you. You brought me right back to where I was back in high school and wanted to have a career in, quote, music.
Where your heart was.
Where my heart was.
That's amazing.
And every one of those steps, I really believe this. The decision I made to get a business degree, the Lord had a hand in it. I really believe that when I went to work with the Boy Scouts, to be connected with those people with National Life and Accident Insurance Company, he had a hand in that. I really believe that when I went to the Ford Motor Company and got experience in labor relations and in industrial relations, the Lord had a hand in it. And every job that I took, coming back to Nashville in personnel, opened the door for me, and Bud Wendell and Giulio Peripoli saw that I had a knack of dealing with people and that I could read a budget sheet.
Yes, sir.
And so that was the step in. If I had come back and tried to get into the entertainment department, I wouldn't have made it.
Yes, sir.
I had to come in at that level, and then the door opened for me to get in.
I do want to say, let's not diminish either, that one of the things that you have spoken about in two or three different ways since we've been sitting here, I have always known about you since I was introduced to you many years ago, where you spoke about your parents and the golden rule. One of the great blessings as well that all of those people you worked with saw, and anybody that knows you today sees in you, is your love and respect for others. It truly, if anybody exemplifies the golden rule that I have ever met in my 64 years on this earth, it is Bob Whitaker. And so it's really neat that you kind of, you know, you keep speaking that God moved you here, there, and there, and I believe all of that, but I also believe that you have had a positive effect on most anybody you have ever touched all the way around. And also, if you think about during that turbulent time in America with civil rights and whatever else, your love and your understanding for other people, I think that was a God thing as well.
That's humbling to me, John. I do love people. And again, I have to go back to my parents. They loved people. And in terms of minorities and integration and all that stuff, if you go back to the history of civil rights area, Cookeville never had a hard time integrating.
Really?
Never. There was a black school in Cookeville, and it served the black students in the Cookeville, here in Cookeville, but it also served counties surrounding us. Black kids were bused into our county, as I recall.
Yes, sir.
The school burned, and Putnam County integrated instead of rebuilding a black school. And this was
without force.
And this was before the civil rights law.
Outstanding.
So my father's mechanic was a black man. Ebo was his name, and he had a family. And when Dad had mechanic work that needed to be done, Ebo would come to Dad's house, and he would do his work, and he'd bring his family with him, and Mother would fix dinner, and we would all have dinner together around our table in our house.
The way it should be.
I have not known.
Yes, sir.
That when you say Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world.
Yes, sir.
Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. I was taught that from the time I was a year old.
Yes, sir. Well, you exemplify it. There's no doubt.
I want to do unto others, and as I look back on it, I really believe that was instilled in me by my parents, and I believe that Bible teaching. I really believe that was that we have to have that. I believe that was necessary, and I'm not a goody-goody. I've got lots of faults, and I made lots of mistakes, and some I've had to go back and apologize for, and I have to tell you, there are things that I'm ashamed of, and I'm not going to talk about those.
Yes, sir.
But I've asked for forgiveness for those, and I have been forgiven.
Yes, you have.
And there's no question in my heart.
Yes, sir.
And I've had to write letters. I've had to make phone calls asking for forgiveness. And fortunately, I've been forgiven in those cases.
Yes, sir.
Welcome back to Whence We Came. Now please join us as we continue our conversation with Mr. Bob Whitaker.
Opryland was a great experience. I worked for the company for 29 years in different phases of the company. 14 years as the entertainment director. Then I went to the General Jackson and GM, the General Jackson Showboat. And I was on the design team to help build a theme park in San Antonio, Texas. That's why I later found out why they sent me to General Jackson, because they knew I could do both of those. And then I went back to the park as an executive administrator for the entire park.
Yes, sir.
And then the company reorganized.
And what years would this be?
I was at the General Jackson in 1988 and 1989. Then I went back to the park in 1990. And I served as the executive administrator in conjunction with the general manager.
Yes, sir.
Giulio Perpoli. And that was 90 to 93. In 93, the company reorganized, and they made a division called the Grand Ole Opry Group, which included the entertainment in the theme park, the Grand Ole Opry, and the entertainment on cruise ships and all the other stuff that were involved with at that time.
Yes, sir.
So I became president of that division, and they gave me an option. They said, you can either manage the Grand Ole Opry and still run this division, or you can hire a manager for the Grand Ole Opry. And I said, that's a no-brainer for me, Bud. I was talking to Bud Wendell, the CEO at this point.
Yes, sir.
He knew I loved country music. Bud and I had hunted together. We'd fished together. He's still a great man. And he established the culture for Opryland. I said, Bud, I want to do both. I want to manage the world-famous Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, sir.
And that was in 1993, and I loved it. And I can't tell you, it's the best gig anybody could ever have.
I have to interject here that we are going to get together again, and I want to just talk about stories from that time in your life, the folks that you know. But I do have a question for you before we go on this. Do you remember, do you have memories of listening to the Grand Ole Opry as a child? Because my dad, I told you, 1929, whatever, they had somebody that was in their community that had a radio, that they didn't have a radio, and they would go to the radio and listen to, my dad told me stories, listening to the Grand Ole Opry that once a week or whatever it was. Do you have memories such as that of the Grand Ole Opry as a child?
Granddad Whitaker had a dry cell battery powered radio. Now, they have a small farm over here on Moss Road, which runs right off of the Cocoa Boat Dock Road.
I've seen Moss Road.
Where Martin Lumber Company.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's Moss Road.
Uh-huh.
Granddad Whitaker had a small farm right there on Moss Road. It wasn't Moss Road then. I don't even know what the name of it was at that time. Did not have electricity. But I would be down there on a weekend, and Granddad would turn on the Grand Ole Opry. And my first memory of the Grand Ole Opry, I'm going to guess, was 5 years old.
Good Lord.
Listening to the Grand Ole Opry and hearing Uncle Dave Macon.
Think of this. A child in Double Springs, Tennessee, in a home that doesn't have indoor plumbing yet.
Nor electricity,
and walks to and from school, milking cows in the morning before he goes, listens to the Grand Ole Opry, fast forward X number of years, and now he's the chairman of it. Remarkable.
It's not just remarkable, it's a miracle.
It's a God thing.
It's a miracle, it's a God thing. If somebody would go back and pull out a paper when I was interviewed or television video or something, say, what is your first memory of the Grand Ole Opry? It's when I was 5 years old at my grandfather's farm, listening to dry. And he would have us get a bucket of water and go out and pour it on a stake where the wire was attached to in order to get a better.
Oh, my Lord. So, I've never heard of that.
And he would not let grandmother, I should say Mammy, he would not let her turn that radio on any other time during the week. It was that battery had to be saved for the Grand Ole Opry. And
it was that to a lot of people, though.
Oh.
You know.
A lot of people don't know this. Back at that time, WSM was a clear channel radio station. It covered 80% of the United States and in several foreign countries. And you could hear the Grand Ole Opry in Wisconsin. You could hear it in Detroit. You could hear it in Florida. You could hear it in Puerto Rico. You could hear it all over. And the incredible thing about it is that there were like three or four radio stations that had clear channel. The Chicago WLSN in Chicago, Shreveport, Louisiana, and there was one in Virginia. There was about four or five radio stations.
Yes, sir.
That covered that. As a matter of fact, the announcer that was brought to Nashville a couple of years after the Grand Ole Opry, the Nashville Barn Dance, was the original show on WSM.
Wow.
And George D. Hay was brought from WLSN in Chicago to Nashville, and he's the one that coined the phrase the Grand Ole Opry.
Really?
And this was about two or three years after the Nashville Barn Dance went on the air from Studio B in the National Life and Accident Insurance Company's building.
Wow.
So, and that's another story, is how WSM got started. But it was a clear channel. So people were listening to the Grand Ole Opry all over the country. And you can go back and see pictures of people in the 50s and in the early 60s standing in line for hours outside the Ryman Auditorium in order to get in on Saturday night. And no air conditioning in that building.
Really?
No air conditioning in that building. But it had the acoustics. It was unbelievable. The Ryman Auditorium was built as a tabernacle and as a church.
Yes, sir.
And it had wood all the way around it, and the acoustics, and it was unbelievable. It still is. Because when we remodeled it back in 1994, 95, they didn't affect all of the wood and the softness that was all around the building. So, but at any rate, the Grand Ole Opry was internationally known as far back as in the 40s and in the 50s. And when we built Opryman, there was a big question as to whether or not Opryman could be successful. And there was a company called the Omni Company, and they did a survey to kind of see where the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville kind of fit in the world. Things like they would take icons. They would say the Empire State Building, and they would take the Leaning Tower, and they would take a lot of the different national or world icons, and they put it up there, and you named where the city was and what was associated with it. And when they put up the Grand Ole Opry, it beat out the Eiffel Tower, it beat out the Empire State Building, it beat out the Washington, D.C. Capitol, beat out all of those as recognizable around the world.
That's amazing.
Nashville, Tennessee was the home of the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, sir.
And it's still known around the world as the number one icon. So, yeah, it was amazing that the boy from Double Springs, in a two-room schoolhouse, got to be manager of the world-famous Grand Ole Opry. I was number six. There was five general managers before me.
I see.
So in the 70s. See, the Grand Ole Opry started in 1925. What are we, 80, 90 years old now? Close to it.
Wow.
95 years old. So.
That's just remarkable. So what years were those that you... How long until you retired?
I was at the Opry from 1993 to the first Monday in 99. I actually retired in the last show in 1998.
The first Monday in 99 that you remember that. That's amazing.
Yeah. it was amazing. And in connection with that, I never really had a retirement because my wife and I were very fortunate. We had the opportunity to buy Mr. Bill Monroe's farm at his death.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's another story. But we moved out there into his little log house, which we had done a little work to. And we lived in that house until we built our house.
Yes, sir.
And on Monday of 1999, I put on an apron, and I went to that house that we were building that had been closed in, the drywall had been done, and it was ready to be trimmed. And my wife bought me 3 saws. And there was the guy who was actually was the general builder and his helper. And we set up the saws. And I cut every single piece of trim that's in that house. Every door jamb, every windowsill, every crown molding, every single piece of trim in that house, I personally cut. Starting with the first day of my retirement. So I worked for 8 months finishing up with the other two men.
Yes, sir.
Finishing up that house.
That's remarkable.
So I never had a, quote, break in my retirement
right.
from working at the Grand Ole Opry and then going the next day, well, what am I going to do today?
Right.
Went right to work. And I worked 6 days a week. And
welcome back to Whence We Came. Now please join us as we continue our conversation with Mr. Bob Whitaker.
I worked for 8 months finishing up with the other two men.
Yes, sir.
Finishing up that house. And another thing that was wonderful memory about that is every single piece of interior wood that's in that house, we cut off of the farm.
Oh, my Lord.
And we had it rough sawed right there on the farm. I brought in a guy who had a portable saw. We rough sawed it, and then we loaded it on a truck, and we brought it to Winnell Lee here in Putnam County.
Yes, sir.
And had it kiln dried and milled.
That is remarkable.
My ties to Putnam County just can't go away.
Yes, sir. And then, well, we're sitting in your lake house, which is in DeKalb County, but it might as well be Putnam County.
Yeah, it's 200 yards from the DeKalb County line.
Yes, sir, I know that as well. I consider it Putnam County. But yes, sir, the ties. Now, when did you purchase this house, this lake house?
Well, actually, this is the third house we've owned on this street.
Really?
I bought our first house, which is next door to your property.
Uh-huh.
I bought the first house in 1991. Then in 2005, I bought Mr. Clarence Newman's house.
Yes, sir,
house,
I remember Mr.
Who,
Newman.
By the way, the first house I bought was across the street from Cecil Montgomery's house.
I remember Mr. Montgomery as well.
Cecil Montgomery, tire engineers, and Clarence Newman had Newman Sales. And both of those gentlemen were my mentors when I was in high school.
Wow.
So I love those guys dearly. And so now I've got 1991. I bought a house across the street from Cecil Montgomery and next door to Clarence Newman's lake house.
Yes, sir.
And just going down the street, D. Rowe Brown had a house on this street. Who was the mayor of Cookeville?
Yes, sir.
And then Hubert Bennett had a house on the street.
Yes, sir.
Who everybody in Cookeville at that time knew Hubert Bennett, still knows who Hubert Bennett was.
Right.
And in 1991, Hubert had passed away, and his widow, her name was Treva Bradshaw until she married Hubert. She lived right across the street from where we are now. This house was owned by Bill and Mrs. Peace.
I didn't know that.
And then what was wonderful about this street is in 1957, I was a junior, summer of 57, I was coming, a rising junior in high school. My classmate, Grover Bennett, invited me and a couple other guys to come down and spend a weekend at this house right across the street, which is where his father...
Right across the street.
That was in 1957. We spent a weekend here, and when I left here, I told Clarence Newman and Cecil Montgomery, I said, one of these days I'm going to own a house on this street. But back at that time, the community had an agreement that they would build no more houses on down here.
Right.
And so they said, Bob, we'd love to have you as a neighbor.
But you're going to have to wait till one of us passes away, apparently.
And so in 1991, a gentleman from Columbus, Ohio, owned the first house we bought. His name was Krieger. And he wanted to sell this house, and I had an opportunity to buy that. And that's how we got to this street.
I see.
Wonderful thing would happen. I'd get off from work on Saturday afternoon and say at 1 o'clock, the park's running, it's open, and I'm coming
right.
We come to the lake. Everybody gets a covered dish, and we have a street lunch right here on this street. And everybody on the street would contribute except your uncle. Uncle John.
John Milligan.
John Milligan. One of the most misunderstood guys in the county.
Yes, sir. That's true.
But John Milligan and I were friends. We were buddies.
Close friends.
And we would meet halfway between our houses, sometimes in each other's house, and we'd spend time just talking.
Yes, sir.
But John would never come down and break bread with us on those weekend parties.
He was a bit of a hermit.
He was a recluse.
Yes, sir.
He was.
And did not suffer fools lightly.
No, he did not. He did not. But we had a good rapport, and I have fond memories of John Milligan. But at any rate, this was how we got up, how I got back to this area.
Yes, sir.
And even though my mom and dad... They still lived in Double Springs, and we visited them regularly. But it was a real joy for me when I got a piece of property on this house, and I ended up selling Clarence's house. Well, and I didn't say that I owned Clarence's house,
right?
And then this house. We at one point had three houses, and we rented two of them. But fortunately, now I have sold those other two.
Yes, sir.
And we live in the house that the Pieces had, and we love it. We just love it. I love the community, and I love the area that we're in, and I like to fish. So I'm having a great time here on this lake.
Yes, sir.
But I want to go back. Those years at Opryland were the absolute most incredible years. And I can truthfully say, I cannot remember a single morning going to work in 29 years that I dreaded going to work.
That is saying a lot.
And we were a service company to millions of people.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So there were opportunities to, in all of those situations, but it was the culture, the people we worked with, was so great that it was just exciting to go to work.
Well, I have my father used to say, had a quote that I use often, speed of the leader, speed of the pack. And when you look at the leadership that both the Grand Ole Opry, Opryland, all of that had, see the quality of people in that leadership, yourself included, it's not unusual to see that what kind of service industry that was.
We would have 2.5-3 million people a year come in 180 days. And the synergy between the Opryland theme park and the Grand Ole Opry and the Opryland Hotel was incredible. because, and I'll just use the Opera Land Hotel, the president of the Opera Land Hotel would come and he'd say, Bob, I've got a big convention that has just canceled out on me, and I've got a lot of empty rooms for week X, whatever it was.
Right.
Can we run a special where we can get a theme park and a Grand Ole Opry ticket and do a hotel special and fill these rooms? We could fill those rooms from the time the word went out, fill them in 3 days.
I always felt it was a brilliant concept. And, and having been to other theme parks before, my family lived in Florida, and then, of course, Atlanta's got family lived in Atlanta as well, Six Flags and those kind of things. And it was so different and so beautiful, so wonderful what you had here.
Well, we had a whole different concept. We were known as the entertainment, the music,
yep,
musical theme park of the industry. Opryland USA, the home of American music.
Right.
And American music included not just the country music, but pop music, Broadway music, rock music, bluegrass, all of that, different types of music. We had them in that, had it in that park. And I took great pride. The entertainment director at Disney and in Six Flags over everywhere, they were friends.
Yes,
and they would call me and say, okay, we got to come up and see what you're doing this year. And they'd say, we can't do what you do. And I'd say, Sonny, we can't do animation.
Right.
You know,
play your strengths. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we were not in competition with Disney. We were not Six Flags. We couldn't build the type of rides that Six Flags did.
Mm-hmm.
We had rides.
Completely different experience.
It's a completely different experience.
Yep.
So I think we had a good relationship with all of the different folks in our industry. And it took, I loved escorting those people through the park.
I bet.
I loved it.
I bet. Well, we've gone on long here, and I want to ask two questions, if I may. One question is, may we get together again and talk about some things, some notes I've written here, and then also some of the special stories from the Opryland years and things such as that?
Sure.
Okay. And the second question I have for you is there anything that I did not ask that you wish I had?
No, John, I think you covered that thing pretty well, and you've already found out once you get me started, I get on a roll, and there are probably some stuff that when you get the editing room, you'll want to cut out.
I doubt that. I think we're going to go with every single bit of it, but I will tell you that this has been every bit the honor and the pleasure I thought it was going to be, and I really appreciate your time, and we will do this again very shortly for round two.
Let me close by saying there are many, 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 many people that I owe thanks to and appreciation to for whatever success I've had in my life. And many of those people are Putnam Countyans and people that opened up doors for me and opened up. I had so many part-time jobs, and people all over this county, and particularly in Cookeville, just said, okay, Bob, we're going to try you out, and they would give me a chance to do whatever. And I can't ever not remember them.
Yes, sir. Well, there'll be a round two and a round three, and I greatly love you and greatly appreciate this time.
My pleasure.
Thank you. See everybody.